From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, President-elect Trump and his threat to slap a big border tax on carmakers who build elsewhere and sell here.
Would an incoming president slap that kind of tariff on, say, an American company based in Detroit, but not a German company based in Munich?
The latest in the proposal to store Canadian nuclear waste underground near Lake Huron.
I've covered different issues over a 25-year career. I have never come across one that is as divisive as this one.
The ripple effect of immigration raids.
These raids affect all sorts of relationships. So relationships between individuals, between family members, between Latino communities and white communities, and also between immigrant and Latino communities and local police departments.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Good to have you with us. When attorneys file briefs with the U.S. Supreme Court, they want to know what will or won't fly with the justices. A political scientist has some advice. Do not try to tug on their heartstrings.
When you use this flashier language, more sort of emotional language, that this is sending a signal to the justices that the credibility of your argument might not be particularly strong.
But first, the auto industry came into the crosshairs of President-elect Trump's Twitter feed this week. He aimed a tweet right at GM, grumbling about GM's building of the Chevy Cruze in Mexico, ending Make in USA or Pay Big Border Tax. Well, guess what? A short time ago, he aimed the same kind of tweet at Toyota, saying Build Plant in US or Pay Big Border Tax. Let's get the business eye view of this as we turn to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, that tweet at GM, now Toyota, pay big border tax. Is that giving folks a message they've been wanting to hear someone say for years, since maybe like NAFTA?
Since like forever?
Yeah.
The short answer is probably yes, at least some people. Certainly in this neck of the woods, where I think a lot of people have equated NAFTA and trade deals with a one-way ticket to no jobs, and all they get is a lousy car or a tie with Trump embroidered on it. So, yes, I think that is something they want to hear. But the reality of the industry today is far more complicated.
Yes. As your column today spells out, what happens when the Trump Build America push smacks up against the reality of today's global marketplace?
Well, I mean, you look at General Motors, for example, builds its Envision midsize sport utility, Buick Envision midsize utility in China. Fiat Chrysler's Jeep Renegade, a compact SUV, comes out of Italy. At the Los Angeles Auto Show, I think all but one model that was debuted by the Detroit automakers was built outside the United States. And that includes, for example, the Chrysler Pacifica minivan, which comes from, admittedly, it's Windsor, but nevertheless, it comes from outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There are many examples of this. And on top of that, you have foreign automakers that are building a lot, investing a lot in Mexico, that are importing those vehicles into the United States. Audi, Volkswagen, Mercedes, and Infiniti are in the process of doing a joint venture to build luxury vehicles and import them into the United States, among other places. So this is happening across the industry.
So Americans who just want to pick the car they want to pick could be in for some ruffled feathers if the president-elect becomes president and gets his way and slaps on that, quote, big border tax.
Well, right. Who's going to pay it? Do you think that the automakers are going to absorb that tariff and it's not going to affect the pricing of the vehicles?
Yeah.
Number one. And number two, would an incoming president slap that kind of tariff on, say, an American company based in Detroit, but not a German company based in Munich or in Stuttgart, or a French-Japanese company with headquarters in Paris and Tokyo? I mean, I think the question answers itself.
Mm-hmm. And if Mr. Trump would possibly get his way with this big border tax, we're going to see some head-spinning things happening with the supply base. They're down there in Mexico, for instance, making a lot of parts and sending them back here to the U.S. And I don't think anyone wouldn't imagine Mexico won't retaliate with its own tariffs.
Well, I think that's right. But I mean, let's before we even get to that, Cynthia, let's talk about the political ramifications. I mean, you've got members of Congress that represent states all over the United States, but particularly in areas that supported Trump and gave him a surprising electoral win. Start with the industrial Midwest and look at the American South. In those two parts of the country is where automotive production is most concentrated. And every one of those members of Congress that has one of those plants in their districts, whether it's a Detroit 3 plant or it's a so-called transplant plant, that's their company. Those are their companies. And if their companies are getting whacked by something that they're normally philosophically opposed to, you think they're just going to sit down and take it? I mean, the reality is that international trade and tariffs and everything, that's not just a presidential prerogative. Congress does have a say in that, and I can guarantee you that they would exercise that prerogative.
So once Mr. Trump becomes our president 2 weeks from tomorrow, what might he do besides threaten on Twitter that would help bring jobs and production back to the U.S. in a way that realizes the realities of the global marketplace?
Well, one, I think, and you heard it from Ford CEO Mark Fields this week, one is to follow through on corporate tax reform and regulatory reform. I think if these auto companies would tell you, and they have been saying publicly, that they are favorably predisposed to some of the things that the Trump administration or incoming administration has been saying on those fronts. That's point one. I think point two would be, can you open or reopen NAFTA and start to look at some of the provisions in it and essentially not repeal it, to use that phrase that's very popular today, repeal and replace, but revise. Look at some of the details. Are there some things, that some agreements that they can come to that might make things a little bit more advantageous to the United States? I think American manufacturers, and frankly, foreign manufacturers, know that it is politically advantageous to them to build where they sell. The reality, though, in the industry is that they don't always build where they sell. And when trade agreements and the cost of doing business exceed the political benefit of building where you sell, guess what? They don't build where they sell. You know, every subcompact that is sold in the United States, I believe, comes from markets outside the United States, with one exception, and that's General Motors Chevrolet Sonic that comes from its Orion Township assembly right here in Southeast Michigan.
Some interesting things as we approach Inauguration Day and beyond. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with us via Skype. As always, Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast and you'll find the link. The Canadian energy company that wants to bury its nuclear waste in an underground site near Lake Huron doubled down this week on that controversial choice. We have reporter Deborah Van Brank of the London Free Press with us now from Ontario. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's good to be on the show.
Ontario Power Generation was ordered to do this study of alternative sites, other places besides the site that's more than 2,200 feet underground at the Bruce Power Plant near Kincardine, right there by Lake Huron. So the report came out this week. What did they find?
They were asked a year ago to look at other sites. One of the big criticisms that had been leveled against the proposal was that they had selected one site only, and studied that one extensively. They were told, you've got to look at other places. So what they did was they looked at a general region of Northern Ontario, which is Granite, and they looked at a general region, not a specific site, of Southern Ontario, which is limestone. And bottom line, they said, was that either of those two sites would be more costly, both to design, to build, to transport people and things to, and it wouldn't result in any additional safety that the Bruce site would have.
You got to wonder, Deborah, here the federal government ordered OPG to examine other sites. Was there any consideration given to having a neutral objective party conduct that study?
The governance aspect of this is that Ontario Power Generation, OPG, is responsible for figuring out how to distribute power in Ontario and how to deal with the waste products. So their mandate was to do all the studies. The third-party review essentially was the joint review panel that took place. They held lots of hearings. I think there were something like 30,000 pages of documents that they had to go through before ultimately they said, this is going to work, and there is, to use their phrase, virtually no chance of safety issues.
Yet, we don't have to look very far to find critics of this proposal on both sides of the border, including virtually all the members of the U.S. Congress from the Great Lakes states.
Yeah.
So what kind of response has this report drawn from critics?
I've covered different issues over a 25-year career. I have never come across one that is as divisive as this one. You are either all in or all against. So we've had response from people like Mike Bradley, the mayor of Sarnia, saying, their conclusion was always going to be Bruce is the only site, and then they worked backwards from that. So it was a foredrawn conclusion, was his response. The mayor of Kincardine said, you know what, due diligence, now we know, we've crossed the T's, dotted the I's, and now let's move ahead because we've studied this one. Let's go.
So very contentious, as it is certainly, you're not going to find many fans in Michigan of this plan, as I'm sure you well know. This issue has been simmering long before Justin Trudeau and the Liberals came into power in Canada in late 2015. Do we have any clue how the Prime Minister feels about this proposal with Bruce Nuclear?
We don't. It became an election issue in the sense that originally the decision to go or no go was to have been made shortly before our federal election. And then a few months before that election took place, the federal environment minister said, you know, let's put a pause on that, effectively taking it off the federal debate and throwing it right into the new prime minister's lap. We don't really know how he feels about this, except that the environment minister of today said in mid-December that we're not going to make a decision on this until near the end of 2017. So it's a really cautious approach. In some respects, it's a test run because it's the first real test of how this government is going to deal with the Great Lakes. And that's a big one. The government has already dealt with some contentious issues environmentally, such as pipelines. Now it's got to figure out, we've got water issues, 40 million people binationally depend on it. What are you going to do next?
Deborah Van Brank, reporter with the London Free Press. Deborah, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Arguing a case before the U.S. Supreme Court is considered by many to be the high point of a lawyer's career. A new study co-authored by a Michigan State University political scientist contains some pretty helpful advice for lawyers as they write briefs for that big case. In a nutshell, don't get flashy and don't try to tug on judicial heartstrings. Ryan Black is an associate professor of political science at Michigan State, and he is an expert on the Supreme Court. Ryan, you say in your study, to win court cases, appeal to the head, not the heart?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. We are interested in looking at the impact of briefs on the votes that Supreme Court justices cast. And so that's what it suggests. It suggests, first of all, that briefs are an important part of the proceedings. So the justices can be swayed by what is inside the briefs. And it's not just the arguments, but it's also the way that you couch the arguments and the language that you use.
And what led you to do this study?
So in political science, we, to exaggerate just a little bit, we tend to think of judges as kind of just politicians who wear fancy black robes. And so that they, for a long time, we've thought that they are sort of pure political machines. And in recent years, we've been trying to push back against that a little bit to think that, you know, there really are some different constraints that that these folks face. And the law is one of those constraints. And the way that the law is communicated with justices is through primarily through the written brief. And so this was a project that we thought of in terms of looking at how the content of the brief could end up influencing their votes.
And I get the feeling that a lot of the public thinks, well, if you talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, we've got the liberals, we've got the conservatives, and they're almost always going to vote based on the leanings irrespective of briefs, but not necessarily.
That's right. That's right. And so what we're just in trying to figure out is, you know, once we control for those ideological leanings, which are very, very well documented and we know make a sizable impact, we're interested in, you know, they're not explaining 100% of the votes that are going on and actually not even explaining close to 100%. And so there's a whole lot of other things that are going into the mix. And one of the contributions of this research is that briefs and the content of briefs is part of that. Should be considered as part of that in the mix.
What happens when an attorney, you know, gets too emotional or gets too flashy in their writing?
So I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is that these are individuals. So the justices are individuals who see hundreds, if not thousands, of legal arguments. And so just like any expert, they develop sort of shortcuts that they see that when they are picking through a brief, that they're able to digest that information much faster than you or I would be able to. And so something that stands out that is different than the norm is going to stand up, but probably in not a particularly good way. And so the argument that we make is that when you use this flashier language, more sort of emotional language, that that this is sending a signal to the justices that the credibility of your argument might not be particularly strong. And the interesting thing is that the justices themselves tell us as much. And Justice Scalia had co-authored a number of books with folks that provide advice to appellate attorneys and tell them what to do. And part of the motivation of the study is to actually test some of that to see if their behavior mirrors what advice they give to attorneys.
Well, so give us an example. What would be a sentence that I might write that perhaps I should not because it goes too far in pushing emotional buttons?
There's a big list of words that psychologists have put together using human subjects where they present them with these words and then ask them to rate them. And it's called the Linguistic Inquiry and Word Count. And a list of several hundred words that are in there, some of the ones that jump out immediately, so the word brutal, for example, irrational, things of those nature on sort of the negative end of things, but then also on the positive side of things, hugs tends to be a word, which probably doesn't appear a whole lot, but hopeful, loved, lucky, all of those types of words have emotional connotations to them. And when sort of confronted with those, again, it's if you sort of hold constant the quality of the argument, our study suggests that that framing it in one particular way is going to be more persuasive to a justice than in another.
So if I was putting my brief together, I might want to write elderly widow seeking to retain her lifelong home instead of what?
Let's see here. Elderly widow seeking to retain her home, adding in some, you know, some words about the circumstances by which the home had been taken, you know, in a unjustified and in a maddening exercise of power. This was taken away by the state or under eminent domain or something along those lines. And so things that make it probably more interesting for you and me to read. Mm-hmm. But the justices, again, they want the arguments that they can then use to craft their opinions. And that's part of what this entire process depends upon.
So I think you're saying don't necessarily rule out emotion, but don't start pulling out the violins.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I think you want to write, you know, you want they want clarity, they want good language, they want something that is not poorly written, but for leaning too hard on sort of the details and leaning too hard on trying to actually make persuasive emotional appeals as opposed to legal appeals are going to be things that probably get you in a little bit more trouble.
Does this hold true, do you think, for lower courts as well?
That's a great question. We, because of the data that were available, we're looking just at the Supreme Court over a few decades, so a decent amount of time. But I think it's absolutely the case that we would find an even bigger impact in the lower courts. The vast majority of decisions in the U.S. Courts of Appeals, for example, don't even have oral argument, and so they are decided purely on the briefs alone. And so I think you'd expect to see a much bigger impact of that signal would be even more powerful for them.
So it really is evidence that when somebody is working their way through law school, they have to retrain the way they write. You have to really, you know, this is not the time for the creative writing. Save that for your John Grisham style novel, I guess, if you're an attorney.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And I think that you know, training attorneys to think, you know, and I think law schools do this, train them to think in analytically rigorous ways and focus on legal persuasiveness as opposed to emotional persuasiveness.
Ryan Black. The study is published in the fall 2016 issue of the Journal of Law and Courts. Great talking with you, Ryan. Thank you so very much for being with us.
You too. Thank you very much.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
The North American International Auto Show begins its media previews on Sunday in Detroit. The show opens to the public on Saturday the 14th. Along with the gleaming displays of new vehicles, the show is going to be a gathering place for innovators from many, many backgrounds, focusing on the future of mobility. Today's guest on The Next Idea has worked in the auto industry, has served in Iraq, and is now the co-founder and partner of Frontinalis Partners, a venture capital firm. He will be at the auto show as a speaker and panelist, and he's looking forward to what he feels is Detroit's future as an innovation hub. Chris Thomas is here with us now, actually from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, so a very, very busy few days for Chris Thomas. Welcome to The Next Idea, Chris.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So you've got background in the auto industry, background in the military, and now you're part of this venture capital firm. So you've got a lot of different perspectives. From where you sit, Chris, how do you think Detroit and Michigan need to be thinking about mobility?
Now, it's a really important question. I've said for many years that Detroit's past and present position it perfectly to drive the future of mobility. And not just in the city or in Southeast Michigan or the state or even the country, but around the world. We have all the attributes that give us the ability to do this. We are the largest transportation technology cluster in the world. People don't necessarily think about that title when they think about Detroit, but we have the best engineers. We have the best people. But what we have to keep in mind is that this is an industry that is evolving incredibly fast. And the amount of people around the world in technology centers and auto centers are looking at mobility. And the question of what mobility is also important. I hope we dive a little bit into that. But they're looking at this space as one that they also want to engage with and they want to win. And so it's incumbent on us to actually take that to heart and work incredibly hard to continue the decades and the centuries of leadership we've had when it comes to the movements of people, goods, and services around the globe.
And Chris, let's dig into this a little bit. You raised a very good question. We use this term mobility. What does that term mean to you? What is mobility to you when I say it?
So for us, we have a very definitive definition. We look at next-generation mobility, which is the space that we invest in, as the movement of goods and services empowered by technology. So what does that mean? To date, we've invested in companies or in entrepreneurs that are focused on kind of revolutionizing movements in road, rail, bike, air, autonomous land-based vehicles, autonomous ocean-going vehicles, cybersecurity, dronal, and artificial intelligence. And we're spending a lot of time right now looking at, you know, global supply chain, autonomous warehousing, first mile, last mile delivery. And all of these things we kind of, you know, look at from the, through the prism of what we call the mosaic of mobility. Individual companies that are going to be leaders from a siloed perspective that are moving in an individual mode or that are empowering an individual sector of mobility. But there's also a tremendous amount of horizontal technologies that are empowering those. And that includes machine learning, artificial intelligence, big data analytics. So we're looking very broadly at the space, and I'm a huge proponent of the need to look at it broadly to make sure that we're not limiting ourselves and just kind of looking through this from an old paradigm and rather really taking advantage of what this space is on a forward-going basis.
There's going to be an event, a very interesting event coming up at the auto show at Kobo that's going to feature more than 50 startup companies pitching their ideas to investors. What, Chris, do you think is the single biggest factor that you see as an indicator of potential success when you're looking at the merits of a startup company?
I think it comes down to team and culture. And we spend a lot of time looking at companies. We've invested in, including our investments in Techstars Mobility, 40-plus companies around the globe, spanning all of the sectors that I just spoke to a moment ago. But in looking at hundreds, thousands of companies over the last 7 years, when we founded Frontinalis in 2009, there are certain things you want. You want, you know, beta-proven product. You want experienced entrepreneurs. You want some revenue generation to make sure that you can kind of validate demand pull for a certain product or service. But at the end of the day, what you're investing in when you're investing in early-stage companies is you're investing in men and women who are incredibly passionate about their ideas and are going to put in the requisite work with the requisite passion to succeed. And so a big part of that is the individuals, and then it's the culture that they foster. You know, are they individuals, and do they have a team that is going to work incredibly well together, that brings different backgrounds to bear, with the goal, rather, of winning, of really, you know, disrupting immense industries, whether it be through channel partnerships, customers, or acquisition, or just, you know, building out their own.
We're speaking with Chris Thomas, who's co-founder and partner of Frontinalis Partners, a venture capital firm. He will be at the upcoming North American International Auto Show as a speaker and as a panelist. What's your message going to be when you speak, Chris? To whom are you speaking and what's the message?
I think that who I'm speaking to is I'm speaking to mobility ecosystem. So that includes all of the traditional, you know, automotive and transportation companies. That includes all of the tech companies that are leaning in incredibly hard and looking to develop and, you know, build within this space. and with people that are interested just in terms of what is mobility and, you know, how can I have an impact in it? How can we ensure that Detroit's going to be relevant and Michigan's going to be relevant in this new ecosystem? And I think that's the other side of the coin. You know, I hope to speak to Michigan and to Detroit. And I live and work in downtown Detroit. We're headquartered in the city right on Jefferson across from Park Plaza. We are incredibly proud that we were the first firm in the world focused on investing in mobility when we founded Fontinalis in 2009. And we did that from Detroit. What I'm hoping to be is, one voice among many incredible people who are going to be speaking at this show, talking about how exciting this opportunity is and, you know, just the fact that we have to get after it. And there's no time to lose.
And so what do you feel, Chris, are Detroit's strengths and weaknesses as the potential hub of mobility innovation?
I think Detroit has tremendous strengths. I think first and foremost, it's people. I think we have the best in the state of Michigan and in Metro Detroit region. We have the most engineers per capita in the world. I believe we have the best engineers in the world. We have tremendous institutional knowledge when it comes to how transportation as a sector has evolved over the last 100 years. So we have tremendous things going for us. What we need to do more of, and what we've started to do, and I'm really excited about, is kind of put on that entrepreneurial hat. Part of that is Techstars and bringing kind of an entrepreneurial ecosystem to Detroit. Young companies that are just getting started that want to develop in mobility and that are working with industry incumbents, you know, OEMs, tier ones, to put together partnerships, to put together new ways of engaging this space and servicing the movement of goods, people, and services. And I think, too, I think we're seeing a tremendous amount of innovation from the incumbents themselves, which is really inspiring. There wasn't always, you know, frankly, a lot of attention or a lot of passion around mobility. You know, it wasn't very sexy when we started, and it's incredibly sexy now. But I think the actions, you know, that are being taken, and actions speak louder than words by, OEMs and tier ones around our region, you know, they are acquiring companies. They are striking meaningful partnerships. They're focusing on the types of technology development and, frankly, external and internal hires they have to make sure that they're going to be a part of the future of the space.
And the state of Michigan, what is the state of Michigan doing right around this issue of better mobility?
I think the recent legislation passed in Lansing around how do we actually supporting the development of autonomous technology. And it's important when you think about autonomous. A lot of people think about autonomous vehicle moving an individual. That's the kind of the go-to use case that comes to mind. But there's tremendous additional sector expertise that's necessary for autonomous to function just in general, but also incredibly safely, which it has to function in that way. And that's one example is cybersecurity. The intense need to ensure that any vehicle that is driving autonomously in no way can be procured by someone who's looking to do something malicious with that vehicle. And there's a variety of others that you have to really think deeply about around what are all the things we need to make this future viable. So I think Michigan has done a good job in the near term. I think the city of Detroit also in the very near term has, you know, said that we are going to be focused on mobility. We want young companies in the space here. We want to see testing here. But one thing that I believe we have to have more of is testing's fantastic. But what is testing by design? It's taking a product that's at the end of its development and ensuring that it's ready to go to market. What we need to make sure we're focused on in Detroit, in Metro Detroit, and in Michigan is developing these technologies. From the ideation process to the startup process to the building these companies out, it's great that there's been huge companies, the Lyfts, the Ubers of the world, billion-dollar companies that are transforming the way people are moving around the world, providing transportation to people at tremendously lower cost than potentially they've had access to it in the past. But I want that next billion-dollar company to be in Michigan. I want the people that found it to be Michiganders. I want to ensure that the opportunities that are going to come from the proliferation of this space's growth are being shared by our people. And I think we have all the ability to do that. You know, government's going to be a piece of it, but it's going to come down to entrepreneurs, and it's going to come down to making sure that, you know, the city and the state, you know, in some ways helps when it can, but also just gets out of the way.
Chris Thomas is co-founder and partner of Frontinalis Partners, a venture capital firm that is based in Detroit. He will be giving a keynote address on the opening of the press previews for the North American International Auto Show this coming Sunday, and then we'll be on some panels during the auto show. And he was kind enough to take time to talk with us from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Chris, thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
No, really a pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Little pin, big goal. That's the motto of Pin Cause. It's the brainchild of two Ann Arbor entrepreneurs. Katie Lind and Nate Stevens have come up with a pin that supports women's rights. And they're hoping the pins will be on a lot of lapels and collars at the upcoming Women's March in Washington the day after Donald Trump's inauguration. Katie Lind, Nate Stevens, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
What led you to come up with Pin Cause?
Katie actually came home with the idea of doing a pin to support the Women's March. And I put together the name Pin Cause because we wanted to create a pin. We have a very important cause. And I put them together. And I searched on GoDaddy to see if the name was available because it sounded so good. I was like, someone must have this. And they didn't. So we immediately bought the website and got to work finding a designer.
So you have this pin, and I'll let you describe it, Katie.
Yeah. So the pin is actually the American Sign Language sign for love from the deaf culture. And so it's your middle finger and your ring finger down, and the others are out. So your thumb and pointer finger actually create an L. Uh-huh. And what we worked with Penelope Dulligan. She worked with us to create something. We said we want to bring together a lot of diverse people and we want this to represent all types of people. And so she was like, her first idea was a hand with lots of different colors to represent bringing together a lot of different types of people.
And the idea, again, with the Women's March is to raise money for causes that are important to you. Tell us about that.
So we wanted to raise money for causes that were connected to women's rights. So we chose the ACLU and Planned Parenthood, and Katie can share how we got to those. And we're selling the pins for $5 each, and then $1 from a pin goes to the ACLU, and then $1 goes to Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, and so I think over the last year, we want it to be nonpartisan, but I will say that I think over the last year, there has been a lot of rumors about policies and different ideas that have come forth that would really infringe on American civil liberties. So that's how we came to the ACLU. They are nonpartisan, and they want to protect us. And so that was the ACLU. And then when it came to protecting rights, women's rights, women's health is a huge part of that. And that's how we came to Planned Parenthood. And I've used Planned Parenthood for a long time. And I love the services. I find them amazing and non-judgmental and just a wonderful place to go. And I would hate, you know, people are really rooting for it to be defunded from different sides. And we would hate to see that happen. So we're showing our support in this way.
And what kind of response have you gotten in terms of inquiries and sales and where they're going to?
So they have been shipped now all over the world to Australia, England, and Canada, our international destinations, and then 43 of the 50 states, from Alaska down to Florida. So that's really exciting. And what the response has been amazing. We actually have on the website, when you go to check out, an opportunity on pincause.com, the opportunity to send us a little note. And people have shared things like, I'm so excited I'm going with my daughter to the march. She's pregnant with a girl and we're just so excited to march. So the outpouring from our customers has just been amazing and people are so excited. And I think one of the things that differentiates us from a lot of what other women, and I'm not knocking it, but I think our message is all about love and inclusion and having conversations. And we're not saying don't be angry, but we're saying it's easier to have a conversation when it opens up with love.
So you're certainly making a statement with this pin. Are there plans for more statements and more pins now that you've kind of seen that here you have the name wasn't taken, you've got the website, so you have pincause.com. What do you think you can do with this platform?
I think we could turn it into something. We can bring pins back. Like you were talking about how you used to wear pins.
Baby boomers. That's right. When the peace sign was a new thing.
Yeah. Yes. So we would love, quarterly or every couple months to have a new pin and have people really involved with finding these causes. And they could be smaller, like the Flint water crisis, or they can be international, like what's happening with Syrian refugees. Mm-hmm. And we can work with fantastic designers similar to Penelope. To create beautiful pins, because that was always a part of it, is that the pin itself had to be beautiful.
And then interesting
and beautiful. And from there, use PINCOS as a platform to raise money for them as well as awareness.
So are you going to sell these the women's pin after the march? Are you going to keep on selling them?
Yeah, so we are going to keep selling them. It does have the date on there. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who don't know the Women's March you mentioned, it is the day after Trump's inauguration. It's on January 21st. They are happening all over the country. However, there's no reason to stop supporting those causes, and it is dated, but I think it'll be a great memorial for something that I think will be amazing that'll happen on January 21st.
Once again, their initiative is called Pin Cause. Caitlin, Nate Stevens, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you so much.
As he campaigned for the presidency, one of Donald Trump's most consistent messages was aimed at undocumented immigrants. At one point, he promised a deportation force to remove millions of undocumented immigrants, and that message helped him get elected. Now, it remains to be seen just what will actually come to pass once he becomes president in 2 weeks. But the increased possibility of immigration raids is certainly out there. Let's talk now about just what happens during those raids and how they affect families and Latino communities in particular and their relationship with local law enforcement. With us now is William Lopez, who's a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Michigan School of Social Work. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And we welcome back to Stateside the Sheriff of Washtenaw County, Jerry Clayton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I am happy to be here.
William, you were in the middle of working and studying the Latino community when one of those immigration raids happened just a few miles from the University of Michigan. Tell us about that.
That's right. So a collaborative survey was occurring in Washtenaw County of Latinos in the community. And the survey, the Encuesta Buenos Vecinos, was about 5 months long. And right in the middle was a pretty big immigration raid. So for the first time, we had data of health data before a raid and after a raid. And we've seen and we've heard, and folks who are in these communities, right, their lives are often shaped by or at least strongly affected by these raids, but research hasn't really caught up. So what we're trying to do is show how quantitatively and qualitatively, because we interviewed folks involved as well, these raids affect all sorts of relationships. So relationships between individuals, between family members, between Latino communities and white communities, and also between immigrant and Latino communities and local police departments.
What happened in that raid in November 2013?
There was a man who had previously been deported and had returned, and the first time he was deported, it was said that he had a weapon with him. So when he was going to be arrested this time, ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, collaborated with the local sheriff's office. Using a SWAT team, they raided his taller, his garage, his automobile shop on the first floor, and an apartment on the second floor. And this raid was the culmination of immigration enforcement that was taking place all day long. So starting when he was arrested at about 8 in the morning, following arrests of folks who drove out of that automobile shop, and then again the raid that happened at about 6 o'clock p.m. And multiple men were detained and were arrested and eventually deported from the auto mechanic shop on the first floor. And women with about 4 children under the age of 5 were in the apartment upstairs when it was raided.
Yes, in fact, I saw from your paper 3 women and there were 4 children under age 5 when this was present. Sheriff Clayton, does your department enforce federal immigration law, or what was your role then?
We do not enforce federal immigration law. Actually, we're very clear. We have a policy on it. We are a law enforcement agency, criminal justice agency, I'll say. So we do cooperate. And so I'll make 2 points. We make it very clear to our deputy sheriffs that if they make a contact with someone, the immigration status of that person is immaterial to us, does not matter. Address whatever reason you make contact with them. Do not ask about immigration status, and we don't do that. In a situation like the situation that Dr. Lopez refers to, when another law enforcement agency comes into our county and makes contact with us and asks for assistance, so we didn't insist in the immigration piece. The reason why we were involved is because they gave us information that this person in the past and could be currently armed and potentially dangerous. And they articulated that they didn't feel that they were equipped to address that situation, so they asked for our SWAT team to assist. That's no different than we do in any other situation, and we have evaluation criteria where we would put SWAT into action. So
and
it was
this
really consistent with that. And I'll add one more piece. So that did fit. Here's the other piece.
Yeah.
ICE, they don't always tell us they're active in the county. Oftentimes they don't tell us. We find out after the fact. And quite frankly, if they told us they were active, we'd want to know, and we actually would want to be present during their activity. Not from an enforcement standpoint, but often what happens is parents are taken. kids are left. Maybe dad's taken, mom might be there, the kids are there. And we want to provide that safety net. So how do we connect maybe the spouse? How do we connect the children to social services to make sure that they don't fall through the gap? And all of a sudden, the breadwinner's gone. The person that's providing the support's gone.
And you don't know it.
And we don't know it. Mm. And the federal, I don't think they have that commitment to the community that we have. So we want to be there to make sure that we fill that gap.
William, talk a little more about – here you had, as a researcher, this mm-hmm. unexpected before and after situation. So you really could study the attitudes and how it impacted people. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So what some research has shown is that after changes to immigration law, immigration enforcement, such as bills that will allow police to enforce immigration law or regulations that – for example, clinics to ask about immigration enforcement, you see a decrease in usage, right, of those mm-hmm. of those resources.
So people are like, I'm not going to go to the doctor. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to call the sheriff's department if I've got a problem because
exactly, because
I'm
of these laws. But what we also see here is that similar changes in behavior are happening after this raid, right? So it's not only policies that may change behaviors in communities. It's also law enforcement events.
Because it's very hard for the community in the middle of something like this to discern what you just spelled out, Sheriff Clayton.
Right.
We're here to support ICE. Right. We didn't do this, but it's you become lumped into this amorphous
exactly.
police.
And I think one of the issues – so I realize that we're talking about an immigration event that happened in 2013.
Sure.
And I often reflect, given what the sheriff's office is doing, what is the value in bringing up events that have happened. Mm-hmm. But even in the recent past, I've been in meetings with the community following an election that engendered a lot of fear in the immigrant community. And folks have just organically brought up mm-hmm. this event, you know, because they affect communities. And one of the things that the sheriff hit on the point exactly, the justification that law enforcement offices use to be involved, local communities don't understand that. What they understand, one mother told me that her son said, the police are the people who take my father away. He didn't say ICE, and he certainly didn't say Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office versus AAPD versus Chelsea PD versus Ipsy PD. That's not how communities think. When we see these law enforcement action happen, we often blur them not only with other police forces, not only with other law enforcement offices, but also with other government services.
And certainly we're saying this happened while you were doing this study in 2013, but not to say that these raids are not happening across the country and certainly happened since. So you could take that effect and multiply it nationwide.
Right, exactly. What we're worried about, I think one of the things that is on many of our minds is if Trump wants to deport 2 to 3 million people, mm-hmm. how is he going to do it, right? And is this what's going to happen? Are we going to use more raids? And if so, what can we do to prepare to stop this from happening and what can we do to prepare for the inevitable fallout?
And back over to where you're from, Sheriff Clayton, as the sheriff of Washtenaw County, I know you've been on this program talking about the community outreach efforts you've made.
Right.
So this certainly runs counter to what it is that you're trying to do in the community.
Exactly. So Dr. Lopez brings up a couple of points. People don't discern the different agencies. They just see it's government and it's police. And they're taking this in for an immigration enforcement action. And what it causes is an underservice of that community. So they go underground, they disengage. And for people that are in the community, like most communities, there's always going to be a percentage of folks that are predators. This creates a lot of space for them to prey on those individuals because they know they're going to be less likely to report the crime for fear that the police are going to come maybe to respond to that call, but also to ask immigration status and see if we can get you out of here. Mm-hmm. So it causes folks to disengage and disconnect. And not only law enforcement, I think Dr. Lopez brings up a good point. So it's not only they disconnect from us, they disconnect for other governmental services that could make their quality of life better. So from a police services standpoint, we learned that we may do the same thing. And I'll just say, if they came to us and said, look, we have concern for safety and all that, we may do the same thing. But I guarantee you we might do it, but we do it in a different way. Sensitive to the impact that has on folks. So now we have new advocate friends. And sometimes it's appropriate if you're not compromising safety and security to reach out to them ahead of time and make sure that we're doing the things necessary to not have a long-term negative impact on that community.
We can't wrap up this discussion without addressing the fact that the kind of things that Donald Trump said about undocumented immigrants throughout the campaign and still since he was elected. They spoke loud and to a lot of people. A lot of people heard that message and they voted for him because of that, you know, deporting people who are, in his words, illegally. They like that. And they feel if you don't follow the rules, you ought to go. And so how do you address this wider climate, this public feeling of, you know what, he's got a point and I like it?
That's a great question. Yeah. I think when groups feel disenfranchised, they will often lash out at other disenfranchised groups. I think Donald Trump spoke to a group who largely felt disenfranchised, and a group that is traditionally focused on when this happens is always undocumented immigrants. We've done this throughout the history of the U.S. During World War II, many immigrants were brought into the U.S., kept the U.S. going as troops were stationed, and then were deported afterwards when troops came back. You know, we've been here before, and we can learn these lessons from the past. This does not have to be the reaction we have. We do not have to focus on immigrants specifically. We are multiple groups who are disenfranchised and disenfranchised in a variety of ways, some very much more so than others, and I don't mean to make it all sound equal. But there are structural things we can do, perhaps to help multiple disenfranchised groups instead of just eliminating folks with whom we feel we're competing.
Anything you want to add to that, Sheriff Clayton?
No, I think we have to remember our history, commit ourselves to not repeating that, and really talk about what are the values of this country. And also remind we all have an immigrant background. Unless you are native to this country, we all have an immigrant background. So let's understand our history. And I'll just add this other piece. I think there's an opportunity for additional solidarity. I think there are people that in the past had not seen themselves as being target of this type of rhetoric that now say, oh, my gosh, you may be talking about what I represent. And for all of us to come together and push back against that, push back against not only his rhetoric, but also remind each other what this country is built on and based on and those values. And I think those values will always win out over hateful rhetoric. We have to stay committed to that.
That's a good place to end our conversation for right now. I know we'll have lots more to talk about. Sheriff of Washtenaw County, Jerry Clayton, and William Lopez, postdoctoral scholar at the University of Michigan School of Social Work. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Melissa Benmark. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.